Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone.
All Susan Steinbrecher with us. She is the author of Kensho, A Modern Awakening, Instigating Change in an Era of Global Renewal. She's an internationally acclaimed businesswoman. She's an executive coach, a speaker, and an author, and president and CEO of Steinbrecher & Associates, a managing consulting firm that provides professional development services in the areas of executive coaching, group facilitation, and leadership training. And let's say, Susan, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I want to go to one word here, and it's such a word that we hear it constantly, and there's power in the word, but it's been used so much that it seems to get, it gets some dilution. And let's talk about the word transformation. Let's define it so we have a base of where we're going to go in the interview and then go from there. So for you, transformation means what?
It means shifting. It means evolving. It means transpiring. It means lots of those things. It's kind of, it means from going from where we are today to moving into a new place, a new reality, a new consciousness, a new way of thinking. So all of that is transforming from where we are to another place entirely.
Okay, so we're talking about really, when we say shifting, we are talking about shifting your ability to the way you think about things. Maybe if I'm looking at something and I see 1, 2, 3 and it's really 4, 5, 6, unless I make that shift, I'm not living in a real world where I'm 1, 2, 3-ing everybody's 4, 5, 6-ing.
That's right. I think that's a great way to put it. It really is. It's about taking a look at where we are today and it's saying, how do I shift my perspective? How do I look at something in a different light, in a new way, with different level of consciousness, if you will? So, yes, it's moving through our old sort of patterns and beliefs and thoughts and way of looking at the world and transforming that by looking at things very differently.
You know, most people go through problems, and it takes them those problems to really realistically awake, take a look, and get a new perspective on life in and of itself. But what do you think it's going to take in this world today where there's so much confusion? You know, whether it's politically, culturally, we look around us and there's so many media messages that we get hit with. We seem to want to get into a little hole and hide or a tunnel somewhere. What do you do to be able to stand up, allow what's going on to go on so you can truly look at it, and then that, take that step for transformation? I think that's really the key. Most people are frightened to death to make that step.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we are bombarded, as you mentioned, with media messages and marketing messages that says, you know, we should be this and we should be that. And then we start measuring where our life is today and looking at that and saying, well, gosh, I don't have that kind of life. Does that mean that I'm not fulfilled? Does that mean I'm not happy? So, you know, part of the reason that I wrote the book, Kensho, A Modern Awakening, is that I really wanted people to realize that, you know, business as usual is no longer going to be usual. You know, we can no longer produce products, services without a conscious. We sort of have this kind of reckless disregard for the impact on self, others, and the planet, and we're going to have to raise our consciousness to take personal responsibility, if you will, for what we put out in the world. So that's what I mean by wanting to shift our consciousness into something more optimistic, if you will. Look at the silver lining of what's happening out there. And part of it is just having that intention, to your point. How do we do this? Well, we start to take a look at where we're sitting at this moment. And is our level of thought, is the way we're viewing the world serving us or not serving us? If it's not serving us, then it's consciously making the choice to do something different. Well, how do we do that? Well, one of the things that we have to do is to, we think the answers of everything are external to us, when in fact a lot of it is internal. So maybe that's through practice of meditation or getting quiet and getting clear about what is it that I want, what will make me happy, what will serve me and serve others in the planet in the future. and getting in touch with that and then starting a step at a time towards that reality, that new reality.
Very key. If you don't know what you want, there's no way that you can that you'll get it, obviously. And I think one of the greatest right. examples of shifting is, let's say you and I are standing in a room together, and you're standing very, very stiff and rigid. Your ankles are together, your hands are at your side, and you're very stiff, and I push you with a certain amount of force. Well, you're going to fall backwards. But what if right. you shifted your position, your legs were open a little bit, and your arms were there, and you got your balance, and I pushed you with the same amount of force. Well, nothing would happen. And I think what we're saying here is, if you shift your position, then the same thing can happen, with the exception of it's all different this time.
Yeah, it's how you view the world. I mean, you know, the truth is we have a tendency to view things based on our past experiences. So what begins to happen is, instead of looking at the reality of what's in front of us, we're filtered through what processes through our brain based on our past experiences. So instead of seeing what's really there, we see something with a certain light or a certain perspective, which may not be reality at all. But because that's what our history tells us is going on, we don't have a fresh pair of eyes, a perspective to look at that event. So by saying, I want to look at things a little different, I want to awaken, which is part of the book title of The Modern Awakening, I want to awaken by saying, how can I look at things differently? And I think it's critically important for us to change our perspective once in a while in order to see ourselves and the world in a new light. And I think only by adopting that type of frame of mind and embracing all that's going on around us and saying, what are the gifts that this particular situation is providing me? What I think everything has a purpose and nothing happens by accident. So when we begin to ask the question, boy, it sure feels difficult right now, but what's the gift of this? What is it I'm supposed to learn from this experience? If we're willing to do that, then the questions start to get answered. What I find happens is we get stuck, and then we start getting upset or depressed or whatever that may be about the situation. But if we can just shift enough to say, what's the lesson here? What am I supposed to take from this experience and learn from this experience? And if you can go there, then it's amazing what will surface.
No, absolutely. I think what I love about books like yours and the questions that you were talking about, if you ask the wrong question, you're going to get the right answers to the wrong question. You're never going to get anywhere. But if you learn to ask the right questions, then you get the right answers. You move forward. And as far as living in the past, a great analogy of that is driving down the highway of life with your hands on the rearview mirror steering, and you get into a lot of accidents and you don't know why. Another shift is put your hands on the steering wheel, and life is different.
Exactly. We're looking at the rearview mirror, looking at what was instead of looking what's ahead of us or being in the present moment with what is now. Exactly right.
And very true. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have today is the population at large, and not necessarily just here in this country, all over the world, have no idea what's going on, have absolutely, quote unquote, no power to change it, or so they think. And we allow ourselves to get into the mess that we have into. I think you said something early on that I'm going to expand on. If we look at the economic condition of the country right now, the cultural problems that we have, and all of those things, the list, and they go on and on. You know whose fault it is? It's my fault. It's your fault. It's everybody out there who's listening. Because if we don't stand up, nothing's going to happen. And there goes those confusing marketing and media messages again. So it's time to get clear. And if we get clear, maybe we can get some answers.
Right, that's right. I think the other thing that many of us have got ourselves really caught into the trap of is that we're not feeling happy. So we've become, you know, true consumers, right? And we're actually called consumers now. We've done so much consuming, we're called consumers. I mean, that says it all to me. And where I'm going with that is that instead of looking at, why am I feeling that compulsion to buy something? Why am I looking at that marketing message and saying, oh, I get it. That's what's going to buy me happiness. That new car, that new house, that bigger car, that new furniture, that new toy. We buy things we can't afford because we think it's going to make us happy, but that happiness is so short-lived that we end up getting ourselves in debt, which creates bigger issues. When the truth is, none of that's going to make us happy anyway, and now we have a bigger problem at hand. So
sure.
You know, American especially has just become consumption mania. You know, we buy and we buy more, and yet our rapid consumerism is not really making us any happier anyway. And so I think that's, I mean, in fact, it's interesting to me. I mean, if you really look at the, it's been estimated that the U.S. National happiness quotient, if you will, peaked sometime in the 1950s. I mean, we're nowhere near where we were, if you think about it, with all the new technology and all the new progression of so-called invention, et cetera. But we're still feeling that pressure, and so whether it's our ego getting in the way or our heart's in the wrong place, it's just not a sustainable strategy. And so that's the trap I think many of us get ourselves caught into.
Well, it's a completely different world than what we built ourselves into with the buy. I remember as a kid, now this is between you and I, in the 50s, you know, with a car. If I had the great car, yeah, it was cool. But what happens if I lost the car? I would confuse myself with what I owned. And I think that in and of itself happens to too many people today. If you don't have this, they're going to think that of you. If you don't have that, and the list goes on. We tend to forget that if you look in the mirror, that's what you have. It's not the house. It's not the car. It's not the dollars. It's what you have inside. And you take some of these young actresses, and we see it constantly. They're worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're in and out of rehab, or they kill themselves. So that should be a lesson to people.
Proves it. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, and the thing is, it takes a lot of courage. I mean, it takes courage to look in the mirror, as you mentioned. It takes courage to really say, why am I feeling this compulsion to buy this? What do I think this is going to do for me? Is that really the truth? So it takes courage to consume less and to say no to that, you know, latest acquisition, because everybody around us may be doing it, and all of a sudden we're like worried about keeping up with the Joneses now, as we get more and more into debt. So instead, the courageous thing to do is to look in the mirror, as you mentioned, and ask, what is going on with me? What is missing? What void am I trying to fill with all the stuff? And just realizing that the solution to this is you're going to have to overhaul your habits. You know, change is difficult. Whether it's taming the consumerism or a host of other addictions for that matter, you know, it really comes down to changing one habit at a time, keeping it simple, baby steps. You know, a good example is I love iced tea. I'm not a coffee drinker, but I am an iced tea drinker, and I would go to this, you know, particular named place to get my tea every day. And one day I looked at myself and I thought, you know, I can actually afford to do this, but why am I doing it? Oh, I get it. It's out of habit. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to go on a kind of a cleanse program, and I'm going to take it completely out of my daily habit or out of my diet, if you will, and see what happens. And I realized after 2 weeks of doing that, I don't really want it anymore. Well, why was I doing it? Because I got in the habit of doing it. So sometimes it's just taking a step, you know.
And it's all about what somebody else is going to think. You know, when you get there, let me give you a prime example of when you get there. Ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead.
Are you good looking?
Funny you should ask that. Absolutely. And if you don't think so, somebody else will. That's the key. If you don't think so, somebody else will. We live our life for somebody else, what somebody's going to think, what somebody's going to do. And it never works, because if I had five women standing in front of me right now, that if I could get behind each one and look through their eyes to see me, I'd see in somebody's eyes, I'd be gorgeous. In somebody else's eyes, I'd be the homeliest thing that there ever was. I can't please everybody. And that's really where
that's
the key
exactly
is.
Right.
When it comes down to living your life for yourself and those people who love you, who like you, who whatever the case may be, that's what you'll draw to you. And if you're drawing people that are causing you to feel that you're not worth it, then you're not, and you're bringing it on.
Well, I love what you said about that, because it really does start with loving oneself. Right? If you worry about what everybody else is going to think and do, you'll be miserable. But you can only focus on self and what you can control and being happy with your own, really, relationship with yourself. So even one of the chapters in the book is called Life, a Love Story. It really is about learning to love oneself, to your point, handsome or not handsome. But once you begin to do that and you really shift your consciousness around that, it's amazing what you begin to attract, because people will feel your centeredness, your peacefulness, your optimism, all of that, your self just your ability to love self and ability, and that permeates throughout the world. And so people feel that within you, and they're drawn to that.
Well, let me hold you up with that one comment. Susan, let me hold you up with that. The people who are drawn to you are the people who have either learned or do love themselves. The people who don't like themselves aren't going to like you no matter what you do, and you're not going to draw them. And effectively, if I don't love me, how am I supposed to love you? If I don't like me, how am I supposed to like you? So when you get all of the qualities that you're talking about and are wonderful qualities, you'll draw those people who love themselves, who like themselves, and you're all on the same page together. That's what's going on in this world right now with culture after culture going against each other and wars and so on and so forth. You got people who just won't allow themselves to change, and they're trained to hate somebody. And that's where hate comes from. It's a learning process. It's trained, and it's a habit. And you just said it. You can break it if you see that there's more value for not hating than there is for hating.
Right. Absolutely right. No, there is just so much around this space for people to really wake up and realize. And again, it's raising our consciousness about how we're going through life day in and day out. And, you know, so my big question to people are you happy and content with where you are in your life? And if you're not, rather than pointing the finger to external factors being everybody else should be doing something differently for me, unfortunately, when we do that, we fall the victim. And when we become that victim, we're really not going to resonate with, to your point, the level of people that you want to be attracting. Unfortunately, sure. You're going to be attracting other victims, right? And I realize it's really difficult.
Yeah, and what it really comes down to, what it really truly comes down to is if the world is nothing more than a reflection of what you like or what you don't like. And when you look in the mirror, what you see in that mirror is what you're going to see outside. And when we get that we're the ones responsible for everything that happens in our life, responsible emotionally how we handle it, and then all of a sudden you get a little stronger and things start to turn around.
Right, that's right. In fact, one of the things that I think is really important is for people to come to terms with what I call their belief systems. You know, we all have what I call mental models. Mental models are just the prevailing belief that we have taken on over time just because we have. And the reality is, you know, we grow up, we all have different life experiences. Based on those life experiences, this shapes our beliefs, which is why nobody can believe exactly as you believe, because they didn't go through your life exactly as you went through it. But the minute you begin to realize that your belief systems are running the show, they're running your life more than you know, and you start to get in touch with that and saying, okay, so who says this is even true about me? So, for example, as an executive coach, I was working with a client, and we were uncovering his mental models and one of those prevailing belief systems, and one of the things that I was really struck by when I first started to work with him is I noticed that he had 5 advanced degrees. That's a lot. You know, that's a lot for anybody. But what was even more striking is he had those 5 advanced degrees were in very challenging degrees, I mean, like nuclear physics and biochemistry. But what was even more striking is when I tell you what his occupation was, he was a chef. Mm. So you look at that and you say, what purpose does this person feel the need to have not only 5 advanced degrees, but advanced degrees that are completely unrelated to his occupation? And what we discovered in his belief system was this belief that he just took on at a very early age that was not true, but he believed it to be true, therefore it was for him, and that belief was, I'm stupid. You can see he spent his whole life, unconsciously, by the way. He just knew he had a thirst for learning. He knew he had almost a compulsion to gain more information. He didn't understand the root of it or where that was coming from. So when we begin to uncover, why am I doing what I'm doing? The mental model is like sprinting on a treadmill with no permission to get off. You just keep going and going and going and going. So it's like an addiction or other addictions. So when you start to ask the question, what is going on with me that's causing me to feel, in his case, I have to get more education? Once that became conscious to him, began to realize that, wow, why do I need 5 advanced degrees? What am I doing? Then he was put in a position to change that. But sometimes you've got to uncover what's running the show and start to get mindful and conscious of what's running the show before you can begin to change it. But by him doing so, then he could take personal responsibility for all the decisions that he had made in his life, some of which served him, some which, frankly, did not serve him very well. It's quite expensive to have 5 advanced degrees and very time-consuming. So forget about work-life balance for him.
Well, let me add something. Oh, by the way, let me tell you what I heard about him, that what you said. If you say, what's a chef? You could say a chef cooks things, but a chef also creates. You know, it's taking this and it's taking that and it's putting it together and then bringing it out. What he was doing with all those degrees was he was coming through his cooking, even though he didn't realize that's what was hiding or surfacing it. And by the way, I would be one of your easiest clients in the world because I know who my mental models are.
Yes.
You ready for this?
Okay. What are they?
John Wayne and the Fonz.
Okay. Tell me more.
No, that's it. John Wayne and the Fonz. If you remember, that's it.
Okay.
Okay. By the way, I've learned a long time ago how to get yourself mindful and how to get yourself in the present. Most people, and I'm sure you work with it all the time, they're living 2 months behind, 2 years ahead, and they're never right here or right now. You ready for this? This is a tough one. Are you sitting by a desk?
I am.
Touch the desk. Did you touch it? The desk just came into existence. Susan, before you touched it, it wasn't even there, was it?
That's right, because now
this is something I learned a long time ago. If you want to get mindful, if you want to get it centered, just touch your chest. It's a conscious alert and goes right to the unconscious to say, get here now.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, we're about running out of time. I could talk to you all night, but Susan, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the best things that I'm offering to folks, because there is some fantastic prizes that we're giving away, is if folks go to kenshobook.com, that's kenshobook.com, we are running a special right now where you can purchase the book through there, but there's a whole myriad of fabulous exercises that really encompass all the things that we're talking about, and tools and free gifts and things that are downloadable and chapters from other books from the numerous people that we interviewed in this book. We just have some stellar people in here. Byron Katie's featured. Marcy Seinroff is featured. James von Prague. We have numerous researchers and scientists and journalists and thought provoking people. That's what I wanted to do, is interview some really incredible minds to ask, how do you do what you do, and bring their concepts to life, which is what's in the book. So a lot of those folks had given us gifts, and as well as many, many other people. So kenshobook.com would be the best place to go so that they could take advantage of the free gifts as well as the book.
Wonderful. And to end it, there was a guest that I had on a month or two ago, and he was a medium. And what he said were, people always ask him, what happens after you die? And he responded to them, what happens when you finally live?
Ah, I love that.
Okay. And with that, hey, thank you so much.
Fantastic.
Okay, good
Absolutely.
Night.
Absolutely. Thank you. Appreciate it.
So many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. We'll be right back. are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Marcus Johnson with us. He's the author of The Call of Destiny, A Liberation from Apathy, Shame, and Failure. He was born and raised in Chicago, and he's currently fielding offers from several top-rated universities. He's the author of two books, and he plans to pursue a political career. And his latest book, again, is called The Call of Destiny, Liberation from Apathy, Shame, and Failure. Marcus, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. How are you?
Oh, I am good, and thank you so much for being here. Politics, huh?
Yes, sir. And just to mention, I'm also the author of The Advancement of Common Humanity, my first published book, and I'm also only, and that book I published when I was 15. I'm currently 17 years old.
Wow, you sound like there's a lot more maturity there, Marcus. Where did the maturity come from? Where did that growth that you have come from?
Well, actually, back in 2008, it was March 1st of 2008 when I received Jesus Christ as my life, Lord, and Savior. And ever since that time, he instilled in me this ability to grow and do great things. And he instilled in me a sense of purpose to actually go out and try to build a legacy for myself in the future. And also, when Barack Obama became the first African-American president, that's what kind of, you know, got me into writing speeches and everything like that. And so in the beginning, I was just more of a speech writer and just, you know, just with the speeches and going out and trying to talk about, you know, Obama and politics and all. But it eventually led into me actually viewing myself as someone who could go out and actually follow the footsteps of President Obama and actually probably be a successful politician one day and, you know, another him and write books. Sure. and all the stuff I do now.
But, okay, well, let me ask you this. What do you see in him? And this is non-political now. What do you see? What is that essence in him that you recognize for yourself that gives you that impetus to go out and be everything you can be?
Well, for one, it's his great public speaking ability, and through that, he's able to give people hope and voice and inspiration for the future. And from a personal point of view, when I look at it, you know, as from an African American point of view, you know, like you got an African American who's going out here and to actually become the first African American president. But it's more than that. But it's his character, it's his ability to reach people and try to do everything he can to be successful and be persistent with for all the things that he cares about. And when I try to connect that with what I'm doing, that's what I see myself doing in the future. Someone who's out there either in politics or business or religion or whatever, going out and trying to reach people and inspire people to do great things and try to pass on a legacy for their children in the future.
If you ever reach that position of president, and let me give you what my experience of being the president of the United States would be. And I've been around for many years, and I've watched many, many people become president and hold different offices. If Hillary Clinton would have won instead of Barack Obama, if she would have gotten into the White House, she would, quote unquote, she would cease becoming a woman. When Barack Obama gets into the White, when he got in the White House, he had to cease becoming an African American. He had to cease becoming a male. He had to cease becoming all of it because they become the symbol of the most powerful person in the world. And all of those things get left behind. And what they are is a reflection of what the country should be. Do you hear it?
Yes.
It's stepping beyond it. And once I think they step beyond it, then you've got a powerhouse. You've got a global leader, male, female, black, white, yellow, orange, brown. It doesn't really matter because there comes that time when you get to that certain level when none of this stuff matters. That what matters is that consciousness within you. And that doesn't have a gender, doesn't have a color, doesn't have a religion. It's the all-powerful somebody that everybody believes in.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's really where it comes to.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And just to add, you know, when he won, I was, you know, fairly much younger, and you know, and I was born when President Clinton was inaugurated, and you know, as George W. Bush became the president, that's when I started to grow up a little and I began to listen. But it was when Barack Obama when he began running for president, that's what, you know, when what really, you know, inspired me to get into politics, and you know, and just, you know, seeing someone like him do it, it just, you know, kind of, you know, it kind of lets me and millions of other people know that all things are possible, no matter who you are, no matter what your race is, and like you said, no matter what your race is, if you believe in yourself and have strong character and do all the things that needs to be done, then whatever it is you're trying to accomplish, you're most likely going to do it.
Well, absolutely, and it all starts in you talk about this, in family values. It's what you're taught.
Yes.
The family has got to be that nucleus of everything that you got. The family's got to be, if you get in trouble outside, you run home, and the minute you get across that doorstep into the house, there's safety there. That's family.
Yes.
And we should be like that with the country, too. You know,
yes.
You get in trouble, you come running home. See, and I think that in and of itself, Marcus, it's the definition of home. I think so many people have lost it today. So many people have lost the definition of what America is, and so on and so forth. Yes, we have been through some horrible things. There's no question about that. But that's not today. And I really believe if we take a look at what we truly want, and everybody gets in the same direction, you know, we're a powerhouse, and we always will be.
Yes.
Now, what are you going to do? You going to go to college first, and then are you going to start out with politics?
Yeah, what I plan to do is I plan to go to a four-year university and get a bachelor's degree in political science, and then immediately after that, I'm going to go to graduate school and get my master's degree in political science, and I'm also going to work on getting my PhD, and while I'm working to get my PhD, I'm either going to be a high school teacher, where I plan to become a high school teacher of government and history, or I may teach political science at maybe a junior college or a community college. And then, once I get my PhD in political science, I'm gonna invite to become a professor of government. And then I'm either going to go to law school or start my own political organization known as the Christian Leadership Council. It would support candidates who believe in Christian values and the Constitution. It would help out. It would even help out education organizations in urban areas. And I also plan to run for office, maybe either for the Congress or Senate, or somewhere in state government. And eventually, I even aspire to run for president someday.
Okay, I tell you what, at each level, and I have been around this business for going on 30 years now, so it's been a long, and I plan to do another 20 or 30. Every time you hit another level, you'll let Radio Suzy know, and we'll have you on the air, and we're going to check you out over the years. How's that?
That's very good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Marcus, do you have a website we can find you at? How do we get the book?
The title of the book?
No, how do we buy the book?
It's on Amazon.com or Flipkart.com or you can go to BarnesandNoble.com. But they're not in the bookstores yet, but they're currently on online resellers. Like I said, Amazon, Flipkart, or Barnes & Noble.
Wonderful. Hey, Marcus Johnson, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck, kid. Go out and get them.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.
Some of these days you'll feel so lonely, you're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby. When I'm gone away, you're gonna feel lonely and want me only. Cause you know, honey, you always got your way. your bony little daddy comes a one of these. Yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss
my kissing.
You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only. Cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you now, some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She is back, Nina Amir. We're talking about writing books and how to write a book. I'm talking about how to blog a book. And across the board, she's an author, she's a book editor, and we're talking tonight about writer's block. Hey, Nina, welcome back.
Thanks, Michael Ray. Good to be here, as usual.
Oh, you sounded good. We got a really good connection.
That's good.
Yeah. Hey, I bet you're on Skype too, aren't you?
I am. The first time.
You know, it's really interesting. There's a sound on Skype that you just don't get on a regular telephone.
Is it really better?
Yeah, it's almost like you're sitting across the desk from me.
Well, that's good because I was worried about it.
Yeah, worked out really good. Hey, writer's block. You know, so many people get it. Let's talk about first what it is, and then we can talk about what causes it. So let's define writer's block. What is it?
Well, it's actually a condition in which a writer loses the ability to produce new work. You know, simply said, they can't write. And the condition varies widely in intensity. It can be kind of trivial, a temporary difficulty in getting words down on paper. And more extreme, some blocked writers have actually been unable to work for years. Mm-hmm. And have even, they've even abandoned their careers because they just can't write.
Wow. Hey, what happens when you get title blockage?
Title blockage? Like you can't write a title to your piece?
Well, mine keeps changing. It's probably changed four times now, but I finally got it. But what is title blockage? That should be a whole new subject, shouldn't it?
Yeah, titles are tough, actually, because you have to cram a lot into a title. And these days, titles are unique because you want your title to be easily searchable on the internet. So you want keywords in your title and, titles are very unique.
Okay, I'm going to give you the new title, but you got to promise not to tell anybody.
Oh, okay.
This is
I'll keep it really secret.
Okay, well, that's it. Talk show secrets. Talk show secrets.
Right, we won't tell anyone. Shh.
No. That's between you and I.
And Susie.
Yeah, oh, wait, Susie, were you listening?
I was.
She heard, too. That's trouble. Okay. Let's talk about some of the causes about blockage now. Does fear have anything to do with it?
It does. There's fear of failure and fear of success and fear of being seen and heard because writers in particular, tend to want to hide behind their computers or their pens and paper. Some writers are quite shy. And so, when you put your work out there in the world, you get seen. So there's a lot of fear involved. It also could be creative problems. You could not be happy with where the project's going. You could be struggling to get started, or you could be struggling with how to proceed with a project or not know how to end it. You could lack inspiration. You could be self-critical. You could really just feel like it's not good enough. Or you could have emotional issues or physical issues. You could be depressed. You could have an illness. You could be dealing with the death of a loved one or divorce or something like that. Or you could even not function well under deadline. A lot of professional writers have writer's block. They just can't function under the pressure. Sometimes people are overwhelmed. Writers are overwhelmed. They feel like the project's too big, or they just can't get their arms around the project. And then there was a woman who wrote a book in 2004 called The Midnight Disease, The Drive to Write, Writer's Block and the Creative Brain. Her name was Alice Flaherty. I don't know if I pronounced it right, F-L-A-H-E-R-T-Y. And she argued that literary creativity was a function of a specific area of the brain, and that writer's block could be the result of brain activity being disrupted. And that's kind of an interesting thought.
I'm going to give you a take on it. We did the math a while back, and all the time I've been on the air, which is going on 30 years now, I have done over 30,000 interviews, probably talking about 31,000 interviews, every subject you can possibly imagine. And let me tell you what I've come to the conclusion of with all of those interviews. For the most part, usually a writer, I don't care what the subject matter is, it's about themselves. It's about something internal, and then it's symbolized outside, but it's framed in such a way that you don't put the two together. And it seems like every time that I take a look at it and I realize what the person's about, that could be a reason for writer's block, because unconsciously they could be realizing they're putting their own world out there. I interviewed, Suze, who did I interview? The Deep Part of the Ocean.
Oh, Jackie Michaud.
You know who that is?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Jackie was actually here, and we did an interview a couple years back. And The Deep End of the Ocean is about women who went on vacation. They're on a boat. Somehow the crew got killed, and the pirates are chasing them. And they're out there, and they have no idea what to do, and they're dealing with survival. So as we got deeper into the interview, and this was public, so I'm not saying anything private, Jackie talked about way back, and I forgot the questions that I asked that led to this, but she talked about way back she was a housewife. Her husband took care of everything. She raised the kids. Everything was paid for. She didn't worry about anything, and he died. She didn't even know how to put a checkbook together. And when he died, she had to survive. And she went through the process of survival, started writing, and obviously became who she is today. But the point of contention was the book was about survival, and her life at a certain point was about survival. And it's very interesting to watch, and I would venture to guess that some part of writer's block is an unconscious a wall not to let everybody know who you are.
But yeah, and that actually gets really scary for writers writing memoirs, because they're really telling their own story. And so they have to get past that, because they're also dealing with the fear of what their families will think. And I work with a lot of writers who are writing memoirs, and they're really dealing with that. How honest can they be, in telling their stories without being afraid that their families will be upset? But beyond that, I work with a lot of nonfiction writers who are writing, straight nonfiction. And I have a client who, for instance, has been beating around the bush with his book. He has a topic that actually was covered quite a number of years ago by another author who wrote a book based on research. And the research in that book got kind of panned and pushed under the table, not because it was wrong or incorrect or anything like that, but because big business didn't want to put it out there. And I don't want to talk about what the specifics, because I don't want to give away his book, but no one really wanted to believe the facts of this research. And this writer is just afraid to put himself out there. He has to take a really big stand and show up in a big way. And that's really scary for him. And so I have to push him to turn out copy. He's always doing all kinds of other things and going off on tangents or saying that he's busy or whatever it is, and he's not turning out copy. And that's a form of writer's block. And it comes from just being scared. And so I have to, as his coach, I have to push him through his fear and just say, you have to sit down today and you have to turn out this much copy and show it to me. And it's just a form of fear. And it's not that much different than the memoir writer, you know, who's afraid of telling the truth about their life. He's got to tell the truth about what he believes that's based on this other research that he knows got panned. But he knows it's true.
I bet any amount of money he was close to his mother.
Well, that's probably true.
Yeah. And some people just need permission. Some people just need to be told what to do. That doesn't mean that they're robots, but there are times when there's so many people who won't do anything without someone saying, you got to do this, you got to do that, and you got to do this, because they're just not going to do it. And it's very interesting, if you watch the personalities, when you're dealing with the personalities, you can see, however they were brought up, good, bad, indifferent, it doesn't matter, goes into their ability to finish it, if they procrastinate, whatever the case may be, or they do it quick, and how the book turns out. And
Right. Again, right.
It's all about them.
Well, and the procrastination is a whole other thing. I mean, people will say they have writer's block, but all they're doing is really procrastinating. They just have some sort of fear. I really think writer's block comes down mostly to fear. And the ones who are procrastinating, they aren't really dealing with their fear. They're just finding ways to avoid what they don't want to do. So maybe they're going off and they're social networking, or they're eating, or they're doing laundry, or they're just finding something else to do. And it's just an excuse rather than sitting down and writing. And if they ask themselves what it was they were avoiding, they'd find out. And I have lots of authors who have that problem. And I have to just tell them, you know, sit down and write the darn book. And what they need really is an accountability partner. And that's what I serve as their coach. I have another client who that's her problem. She's always telling me, I'm too busy. I don't have enough time. This week was just too busy. I had this come up and that come up. And I keep saying, it's not acceptable. This is just not okay. Here's the deal. You have to turn out this many pages per week to show me, period. That's why I'm here. That's what you pay me for. You have to turn out this number of pages, period.
You know, by the way, I think it's an excellent way to work with a lot of people. And it puts a deadline on it, causes them to be able to do it. And if they do it long enough, repetition of action creates habit.
Sure it does. Sure it does.
Yeah. Love every second of it.
Yeah.
Now,
and you.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, you have the other people who are perfectionists. You know, I worked with a writer who couldn't sit down and write because he never felt his writing was good enough. And I had to do the same thing with him. I had to give him deadlines and make him turn something into me. And there are a lot of people with a really strong inner critic. And, you know, that could also come from a parent who was always criticizing them and telling them they weren't good enough. And, you know, I had to just tell him that he had to turn in a certain number of pages, and then I would edit them, and I had to be really kind about it, and I had to assure him that his writing was okay and that it may not have been perfect, but it was perfect enough. And that was enough to keep him writing. But without that, he was totally immobilized and couldn't do it.
You know, I always say, you know, thank God for Susie, and there's a few other people that yell at me, and that we make sure that she's doing it, that makes sure it gets done. You know, we talk about procrastination and perfectionism. Oh, wait, the desk is dirty. I can't write. So, you know, we have to take 2 hours and clean the desk up. Then I'm ready to go.
But that's right.
I think deadlines and everything else are absolutely wonderful. Now, what do you offer to somebody that doesn't have a coach?
So the tips that they can have for moving through their procrastination or whatever they're calling writer's block?
That too, yes.
I would say, number one, give yourself deadlines. So people don't like deadlines. I think deadlines are the biggest gift you can give yourself, especially deadlines that, you know, for instance, maybe you have to go somewhere and you say, okay, I'm going to bring, you know, something to read there, or I'm going to bring a published, you know, self-published book or whatever it is. So give yourself deadlines. And then I'd say write fast with a timer. So, you know, sit down for 30 minutes or whatever it is and have a timer and write as fast as you can, and don't edit while you write. Just write as fast as you can. Don't even look at it. Just get something written, because you don't want that inner critic working while you write. I suggest you blog your book. get your writing out in the public eye in a way that allows you to get over that fear of being seen and heard, or seen and read. And having a blog is a great way to do that. If you don't want to actually blog your book, at least have a blog where you can be putting your writing out in the public so you get used to that. Also, have a time when you're going to write and turn off your phones and the internet and all of that, where it's just quiet and it's just you and the page, and have a set time to write so that that way it's every day or every 3 days or whatever, you know, whatever it is, but it's your time and you sit down and it's, you know, like a religious thing. You do it all the time at the same time. And then write in short bursts. That's why blogging is so good, because blogging is short. Usually, you know, you only need to write about 250 words. And you can do that in, you know, 15 or 30 minutes. So set it up that way. Even if you're not going to blog, set up your writing time in those kind of short bursts, just 30 minutes, 250 words, and just do it over and over again. And then the last one would be to have an accountability partner. Find a coach. A writing coach, or find an editor, someone you're turning your work into. I mean, it can even be a fellow writer, just someone who's going to be there to say, did you do what you said you were going to do today? Did you write your 2 pages? Did you write your 250 words? You know, did you keep up over this week with the writing goals that you set out? And someone who can say, these are my writing goals, and they're gonna ask you whether you met them. Those are the things I would suggest.
You know why I was resisting this interview tonight?
Why?
Because I'm Jewish and my guilt is coming up now. I've been going to have my blog to you for a month and a half now.
That's true.
I know.
You have missed your blog deadline.
I know. Oh, Mama Coach is coming out. I just
I know. And actually, every time I email you, it bounces back. What's with that?
Is it really?
Yes.
Oh, wonder what's going on. All right, I'm going to have to figure something. Somebody said Mercury is in retrograde.
That's what it is. So no, I can't even hound you about your blog.
I'm going to get that blog out. I will be calling you personally, privately, to tell you what's going on. Some super dynamite stuff. But no, I got to get my blog to you. I know. That's what I said. I looked at it. Right. Oh, guilt. Guilt.
Even
guilt.
Bigger than that, you need to finish your book.
Well, there was a reason for not doing that, and the book will be finished now within a month. And Susie's over going, yeah, sure, right. I didn't want this interview. You forced.
Get that book written.
I knew it.
Get it done.
Yes. Yes. I like that. Okay. Give me a deadline. I'll do it.
Okay. I'm not giving you a deadline. You pick one.
No.
It's your book.
I got it. And you're not. We can't tell anybody. That title has changed 4 times now.
Oh, yeah, you never did tell us the title.
I did. You didn't hear it.
It's a secret?
That the talk show secrets.
Okay.
Yes, yes. Right. I mean, good stuff. All right, everything else is cool. And by the way, 80% of it is what it was. There's just a lot of different little changes in there now. And we're going to roll from there. Okay, we're about out of time. I've had the guilt is it's
the Jewish guilt. I had to put it on you.
I know. I got it. I'm from both sides here. Okay. website we can find you at.
You can find me at www.copywritecommunications.com.
Wonderful, Nina Amir. See you next week.
All right, will do. Have a good week.
Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a long time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Ryan Blair with us. He's the author of Nothing to Lose, Everything to Gain, How I Went from Gang Member to Multimillionaire Entrepreneur. The first decade of his life was spent comfortably, growing up in a middle-class neighborhood in Southern California. Then it came to an abrupt halt when his abusive father became hooked on drugs and abandoned him and his mother. And he went from a life filled with swimming pools and presents under the tree every year to living in a bad neighborhood where crime and violence were king. Destitute, he joined a gang just to survive, and he found himself in and out of juvenile detention. Today, he's a social-made millionaire and a serial entrepreneur, creating and selling three companies worth hundreds of millions of dollars, the first which he started at the age of 21. And hey, Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Now, but let's go back to when your dad left. Okay, he left. He left your mom and yourself. There was no income. What area did you move into?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'll never forget, you know, as a young kid growing up in the middle class, there's so many kids out there today whose families are struggling. My family is struggling because of some poor decisions my dad made, but there's a number of them just struggling because of the economy and because of what's going on out there. And you know, I'll never forget, as everything was repossessed, you know, my mom and I packed up our bags. We moved into a neighborhood in Los Angeles, and literally the day we moved in, we were robbed blind, every possession taken from us. And that was how I started my new life in a bad neighborhood. And shortly after that, you know, next thing you know, I'm hanging around the wrong crowd. Have a lot of bad influences from, you know, the older kids in the neighborhood, and some of them were men. And next thing you know, I'm doing errands and running, you know, with the wrong crowd.
Now, by the way, when you fell in with the wrong crowd, was it something about acceptance? You know, we have a family accepts us. All of a sudden, there's a big rejection there.
Yeah.
Was there anybody else in your life? Yeah. Okay.
Well, you know, and I'll tell you this. One of my key messages is I'm a father. I'm 34 years old. And, you know, and one of the key messages that I have in my book and focus is, you know, right now we're the fatherless generation. It's because I had the absence of a male role model at 13 years old that I desperately sought one. And in a bad neighborhood or any neighborhood, male role models will show up there. And a lot of times they're not role models at all. They're, in fact, criminals or people with ill intentions. And so one of my key messages is to mothers out there, find your kids' mentors. That's what my mom did for me, and that's what ultimately rescued me and ultimately, you know, made me a person who's now a contribution to society. So, you know, that's a key message. In the absence of a male role model, your son will find one, or your daughter will find one. And as a result of that, you may have something that, you know, that isn't a good situation. So that's one of my key messages with the book, and I write a lot about that.
Yeah, but Ryan, let's add something to that, because I don't want to get this missed. The role model is always there, but where are you going to get the role model? It's going to either come from a family that's got some stability or, quote-unquote, the older guy in the gang that tells you this is what to do and this is how to do it. You got to have somebody to model to model again.
No, you're right. And I would say to every mother out there that's worried about their children or worried about, you know, the family situation, as mine was, In today's day and age, you can put your child in the right environment. You could put them on online radio like this. You could put them on Facebook. You can find male, you know, people that your son can model, your daughter can model, even remotely. Buy books. Surround them with this information, because, you know, a mother can't be a father to her son, but she can help show her son what the right male role model looks like and have him pick from, you know, a variety of them. So, you know, that's the one thing I think a lot of times mothers don't do, is I think a lot of times they try to be that model, and it's so difficult to do that, you know, boys to girls, girls to boys. You got to just find a model for their child, and I would spare no time, effort, energy doing that, whether it be putting them in sports, putting the child in after school activities and just getting that child into an environment where they can pick their mentor. In fact, in my business, Vitalis, mothers, single mothers all the time bring the kids to events. There's no greater joy that I have than, you know, signing a 14-year-old's book and shaking his hand and knowing that that child is now looking to me as a model as opposed to the wrong person.
You see, but when you come right down to it, and if you think about this, the best thing that ever happened in your life is when your father walked out. Look at the kids and the lives that wouldn't be touched right now had that not happened to you. And, Ryan, there had to be an inner strength in you, because what you have, I can hear you, I can feel it. To do what you're doing as an entrepreneur in business and helping the kids and the rest of it, that's something you don't learn. You have to have it inside of you. And what would have been an absolute shame if you would have been involved in something really bad and went to jail for the next 30 years and everybody would have lost what you had to offer. So that's something else.
I've created thousands of jobs, right? You know, this is a hot topic in today's environment here. I've created thousands of jobs. I've pledged to Urban Born, a charity I'm very passionate about. Through my foundation, I pledged $100,000 to teach entrepreneurship in the schools. I've raised 800,000 meals for at-risk kids that are literally going hungry right now throughout America. And, you know, and not only that, the economic contribution through my taxes and through, you know, the donations I made and all those other things, all of that happened because of a male role model, because I learned the subject of entrepreneurship, and because of my mother, and it wouldn't have happened otherwise. So my mission is to literally shift some of the most talented kids on our planet, like I was. You know, I was ADD. I was diagnosed with dyslexia. I mean, I had all kinds of reasons why I didn't believe I'd be successful. But the moment somebody believed in me, I took off running. And there's a lot of opportunity out there to do the same for a lot of people.
There was an interview that I did years ago. I've talked about it on the air before, but it's germane to the issue now, and it's very important. Probably 20, 25 years ago, there was a man who was a doctor, and he had been working, I think it was in South Africa, and it was on the AIDS projects and so on and so forth. And I asked him, I said, when these kids are 23, 24 years old, what happens to them? He said, well, most of them die. You know, there's nothing to look forward to, and there's no schools, there's no jobs, there's no anything. So the real, and he's talking about getting education out there. Education is not going to do it. Everybody knows. The key was the value for living, or the value for having sex with somebody and getting ADD and die. There was no value for going on. So why mess with it? And why not just have sex? The point was to create a value there in that country where they had something to look forward to. That's the same thing we are talking about now. The value for going to school, going beyond what the neighborhood has to offer, has got to be greater than the value for what the neighborhood offers at the moment.
And you know, and that's one of the reasons why I'm out there doing this. That's why I wrote a book. I didn't write the book because I wanted to brag about myself. In fact, 100% of the profits that I make from my book go to Urban Born to equip these kids with entrepreneurial skills. A lot of them actually get into entrepreneurship. Unfortunately, they get into illegal entrepreneurship. They get into drugs. They get into guns. They get into, you know, stealing, robbing, all kinds of other things. And so my goal is, I used to see professional criminals, you know, literally cartels running the streets of my neighborhood. My goal is to take those kids and give them hope and show them that their tenacity, their hustle, their adversity, their disadvantages can be their advantages. And that's why I wrote the book, and that's, you know, nothing to lose, everything to gain. That's why the title is that, because when you have nothing to lose, you really do have an opportunity that a lot of people don't. A lot of middle-class people really think they have a lot to lose, so they never take action. And so I always tell people is that's your advantage, not your disadvantage.
Well, absolutely, and I would say that the master criminal, quote-unquote, the people leading it, most of them are brilliant. And what would happen if they took that shift and, as you said, put it somewhere constructive, all of a sudden we'd have a different world out there. But let me ask you, you were right in the middle of it. You know, I came from an era, I was brought up in Southern California also, but I came up in a world that was completely different than what you were brought in, what you were born with. By the way, what area of Los Angeles was this all happening?
In the San Fernando Valley area. And it was a time, I don't know if you recall, in the early 90s, when gangs were glorified. The coolest thing to do was to become a gang member. In fact, this was the time when the movie Colors was out, Boys in the Hood, and everybody wanted to get involved in gangs. And I remember, because there was a lot of kids that didn't need to be in a gang, they weren't necessarily from my side of the tracks, and you know, the poor side, but they were getting caught up in it. And in fact, just the other day, a kid that I knew just got released from prison from a time that I was right there with him when he decided to, you know, get involved in a criminal activity. I decided not to, and he went and did 20 years for that. So, you know, I saw, I think it was close to 20. I saw firsthand people get shot. I saw firsthand the influence that the drugs cartels and professional criminals had over the neighborhood. And I always knew, because I was raised spiritually, that I didn't, you know, I didn't want to kind of break the Ten Commandments. I didn't want to, you know, ruin my shot at a life worth living. And so I never really crossed that line. I did cross a lot of them, and I've since, you know, repented and made a lot of contribution to our society as a result. But, you know, there's a lot of kids out there, and I speak at juvenile halls, and, you know, and also there's a lot of kids out there that aren't necessarily in a bad neighborhood, but those kids are still at risk. In fact, every kid is at risk right now with drugs, with what's going on with popular media. In my opinion, every kid without a plan is at risk, regardless if they're in a million-dollar house or they're in a, you know, $50 house like I was.
No, by the way, from the early 70s until 1982, I lived in the San Fernando Valley also. I was in, you know, Sherman Oaks and Encino in that area. And there weren't gangs. You could walk down the street. Nobody was going to shoot you. None of that stuff, I won't say none, but a very small amount was going on. This had to happen, Ryan, in the 90s. It had to happen overnight, and there had to be a reason for it happening. You can't just transition in a particular geographical location to have such a drastic culture change. What do you think it truly was at that point?
I mean, we are in the age of the fatherless generation. What happened was we lost family values. We lost, we quit putting a high value on being a father, regardless if you're in a divorce situation or whatever the case is. There's a lot of men out there that just don't step up and teach their children values. I mean, I think the cultural change that happened, that occurred, and if you study, you know, how culture changes, it changes generally because a family structure changes. It changes because a value structure changes. And that change could be as a result of a recession or a bad economy. But in our case, we live in America. I mean, even when the Dow's down 500 points and all this stuff happening because of all this political rhetoric and all that stuff going on, you still have the greatest opportunity on the planet to transform from one socioeconomic status to another. I mean, you have education all around you. You have books available. You know, you can download them to your Kindle, your computer. I mean, you have access to Facebook. I mean, people online right now that want my mentorship could literally be following me on Twitter, reaching out to me on Facebook, and then engaging with me, even if they lived in Compton or, you know, a lesser socioeconomic neighborhood. So, in my opinion, there's no excuses, you know, for being in your present situation if you want out of it.
Now, by the way, one of the things that's going on in this country today that you can be a great help for it not to happen or get any worse. You know, we are the most powerful force in the world. You don't stand toe-to-toe with the United States of America. So if you want us, what you do is you get us from the inside. You cause us to implode. You start to divide. You start to separate. And what's going on now is the divisions between the colors, the divisions between the religions. I can go on and on with this. So if your message gets out there strong enough and dads step up to the plate, none of this can be happening. There's where the problem is. The other problem is the way the law is set up right now. I'm an old timer and I don't have any teenagers, but I came from a place where if you stepped out of line, you got whacked on the rear end. You didn't get beaten. It wasn't any blood, but it was consequence. This is what happens if you step out of line. You can't do that today, because if you do, when you get up in the morning and you go to breakfast, the kid's standing there with either child enforcement or their attorney. You know, fathers have a pretty hard time today because you can't really put your foot down.
Yeah, you know, and I think a lot about that. You know, I have a 2-year-old son. He's my pride and joy. I mean, I want to do nothing but spend the rest of my life teaching him how to be a better man than I was and showing him the right road, so that way he has the best opportunity in life and he can follow in my footsteps and be even more of a contribution than I can be to our planet. I think that it's a matter of really instilling values in your children, giving them a higher purpose in life, and believing in them. You know, I was a kid who no one believed in ever. I mean, the social services didn't believe in me. No one believed in me, period, except for my mother. But she couldn't lead me. So one, the moment she gave me an opportunity to meet a man who was an entrepreneur, who started believing in me and teaching me values and having me read books and really give me, he gave me a whole new confidence level, I took off running. And there's so many kids out there that have low self-esteem, and there's so many, you know what, there's adults out there that have low self-esteem. You have no idea how many times I meet a person that says, well, my dad was abusive, and that's why I can't be successful, and I let that, you know, stop me from having what I want out of life. And I just say, make your disadvantage your advantage, and you can do that. Everybody can do that in this day and age. There's no excuses. You just have to find solutions.
Well, absolutely. And by the way, a good swat in the rear end, and I'll give you this analogy. Your kid's 7 years old, and he or she is walking out into traffic. You can't sit down and have a conversation of the good and the bad and the consequence. You whack them in the rear end, and you say, don't do that again. And believe me, before they step out of the traffic, they think about the little sting on their butt. And there is nothing wrong with that because it didn't destroy anybody emotionally.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's an interesting, us human beings are hard to train, and once we're trained with bad habits, as we all know, we're really hard to untrain. So, you know, hopefully you're instilling, you know, the values and, you know, and safety and everything else, as you've said, early on. But if you're not, you can still unwind bad habits, and you can still change bad belief systems, and you can, you know, you can improve. And in fact, I'll tell you this, I look myself every single day in the mirror, and I say, you know, there's something I got to work on. I'm not achieving exactly what I want to achieve. And most of the time, it's because of self-implied things or, you know, things that I'm not focused on or focused on too many things. And in my book, I talk a lot about that because, you know, I have a lot of internal dialogue that has enabled me to, you know, build, you know, right now my company is doing $20 million a month in sales, you know, and growing at, you know, 20%+ per month. We're on track to be the next billion-dollar company in the direct selling industry. And the only way that I'll get there is if I'm constantly seeking to get better, to get smarter, and to be, you know, to take more action on a daily basis.
Okay, well, here's a point. This, I think it's a major point. If you have somebody working for you that's supposed to show up on time, that never shows up on time, that sometimes gets there and they're not always there, you're going to fire them, aren't you?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. There's been a number of incidences where I've lost my temper over people not actually, you know, being smart about their time, being on time, and really just showing an investment in that they value their opportunity. And, you know, and that's what bothers me the most is this pervasive laziness in our society where people are not realize, you know, they're not taking action. It's almost like we've enabled people to be spoiled, where they really believe they can, you know, they can devalue time, they can devalue themselves, and they can, you know, they can do anything that they want, or they're content with their middle-class environment. And the sad news is, you know, what happens when we go into a recession, which it looks like we're very much heading into one, the middle class is going to get it ripped away from them once again, and we're going to have a destabilization in the people that are, they're the ones sitting on the couch. And what happens with guys like me is I take action during recessions. I mean, our company, Visalis, was about to go bankrupt December 2009. We were down to $600,000 a month in sales. We were losing nearly $600,000 a month. And we took massive action, myself and my co-founders and team. And the next thing you know, we're the fastest growing company, extremely profitable, doing $20+ million a month, roughly 18 months later. And what happened? Why? Because we took action when no one else did. But most people will just sit there, sorry, on the couch saying, oh, terrible, the economy is melting down, this, that, and the other, as opposed to saying, this is my shot.
Yeah, but see, Ryan, there's something called consequence. And without that little swat in the rear end, they don't understand the word consequence, and they grow with it, and they can get in trouble in school but because they can do what they want to do, so there's no consequence. They get out into the world. They get into a job. I don't have to be there. There's no consequence. I've got my rights. Yeah, right. But the point of contentment, you got it.
You know what's funny is JFK has a quote, I'll paraphrase it here, so the consequences of inaction are greater than the consequence of action.
Yeah, no question.
A lot of times people don't take any action whatsoever. They go, you know, they tell me, I want to be an entrepreneur, but they don't actually read the book. They tell me, I want your mentorship, but they don't actually go to my blog. They tell me, they just won't take the action. And truth is, the consequences of inaction are greater than the consequence of almost any action.
Yeah, you bet. You bet. And when the end of the day comes by, everything that's happened to you, if you take responsibility, I can't stop you from walking up and smacking me in the nose. But I can control how I feel about it. You hear the difference?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's the thing. There's an old saying, nothing has meaning except the meaning you give it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, a lot of times people give the wrong meaning, or they create, you know, they create a reason why they're going to be a failure as opposed to a reason why they're going to be successful. One of the reasons why I got my book to number one and I pushed so hard was because deep down inside, I wanted to share my story and help a lot of people get through their own stories. Now, you know, had I not, and it was tough. I mean, you know, I'm on tour right now. I'm doing these signings. I have companies I'm investing in. I mean, this is not an easy thing for me to do. And I'm financially in a position where I could retire for the rest of my life and not care. I could go buy an island and live on it forever. But reason why I'm doing this and the reason why I'm focused is because of other people. So it's, you know, it's like a purpose thing. What happens is a lot of people, they just don't have a really deep enough reason why they're going to be successful. For me, it's for my son. It's for our society. It's for our community. And it's to make a difference, right? It's for, you know, God. I'm a very spiritual person. So for me, it's I'm doing that. But a lot of people, they just don't have a big enough reason why they should take action, even in insecure times and uncertainty.
No question. Ryan, we're starting to run out of time. And is there a website we can find you and the book and everything else about you?
Yeah, absolutely. Go to nothingtolose.com. You know, nothing to lose, the common American expression, nothingtolose.com. You can connect with me on Twitter. You can. It has links to where the book is available. And right now I'm giving away a CEO course, which is a four-week course. If anyone shows a proof of purchase with the book, the course starts in September. So it's a four-week online CEO course for anyone who goes to nothingtolose.com and submits a proof of purchase with the book. And it's going to be a fantastic opportunity to get mentorship from me and learn how to be a CEO of your own entrepreneurial venture.
Love every second of it. Hey, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciated your time, and I appreciate you. Go get him, kid.
Yeah, thank you. I hope to come back on sometime. You're a great guy. I appreciate it very much.
Good night.
All right, bye-bye.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jennifer Elizabeth Masters with us. She is the author of Odyssey, Victim to Victory. She's an ordained minister, and she's a life coach, a healer, a teacher, a certified hypnotherapist. This is her first book, Odyssey, Victim to Victory. And let me just do this right before I bring her on. Married for the first time at 18, divorced before she was 21, on her third marriage and pregnant at 40, and she had to know this was the one, but within the first year, it was a mistake and she knew it. Why? What causes people to do this? What causes people to go over and over and over again and end up depressed? And let us ask her. Jennifer, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. When we are dealing with it, you know, your story is like so many other people, male or female, doesn't really matter. You know, it goes the back and forth. What causes people to go through these things? And it always seems to end up the same problem. Have you found some kind of an overarching theme, a common reason why this happens?
Well, it's interesting because I'm on the heels of a gentleman who experienced the same thing I did in childhood, which 25 million Americans have been molested in their childhood, and I was one of those. My experience from the beginning was one of abuse, molestation. I ended up feeling guilty and depressed. I was an anxious child and a people pleaser. My mother had been abused and molested as well, and what oftentimes happens is that people are in families where for generations this has been the case, where there's been molestation and abuse in the family. And so with that as a background, it's the whole backdrop for our life. It permeates all of our relationships into adulthood unless something is done to change those patterns.
Jennifer, let me hold you up for a second, because what I've seen happen many times over and over and over again, the pattern is there. The pattern is unconscious. You automatically do this. So you don't think about this, but you end up picking the person that's going to cause the same problem. If you're rejected and if you're and if you have been abandoned and or taken advantage of, somehow you're going to get that same person over and over and over again until the day comes when you're done with it. And you have to go find out why this is happening to you. So we're responsible. We draw those people to us until we realize that we don't have to do that.
Absolutely. And that's what happened with me. I realized, and I could be, I guess, perceived as a slow learner, that it took me so many marriages, but I was brought up to have sex in marriage as opposed to outside of marriage. So I finally realized when looking at all the past relationships I've had, the common denominator was me. So through self-analysis and counseling and therapy, I realized I was blaming everyone in my life and not being responsible. And you already made that point. A lot of people that have been abused as children don't have healthy boundaries. And then because they don't have healthy boundaries, then they're constantly taken advantage of. They don't know when to stop or when to say no, because no didn't mean no in their childhood.
One of the things that I have found over the years basically is this. If I were, and I won't ask you the question, but if I were to ask you to describe your mom or your dad emotionally, not physically, but emotionally, and then describe the first husband emotionally, the second husband emotionally, the third husband emotionally, and the guy that you like now. And I think what you'll find is one of them, that one of these guys were either mom or dad, one way or the other. And it was like the same person, but in a different body across the board. And we don't realize that. They may look differently, but they're not. They're the same exact person until you finally had enough where you wake up to it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's definitely the case. In my case, I found disconnected people who were unavailable emotionally with a lot of anger and rage. And it's been my experience through the work I've done with clients is that we're not allowed to express ourselves emotionally. We're not allowed to really be angry. And what happens is when you hold all that emotion in, eventually it's got to find an exit point. And that's why we're seeing road rage and, you know, people shooting up post offices and judges in chambers, et cetera.
You know, I had a friend of mine years and years ago, and he had a doctorate in divinity, and he had traveled to the Romance countries. He traveled to Spain and Portugal and Italy, those countries in that particular geographic area. Now, what he found was that it was predominantly it was Catholic dominated as far as the religion, and it was very interesting with what he came up with when he went into the hospitals. He found that those in those countries, the psychiatric beds were less filled than the rest of Europe, and the reason for that was the confession. And what he had found was when people were confessing, they were dumping it. They weren't having to hold it inside, and then it wasn't. They got to externalize it, and it didn't get to hold and fester and cause all the problems that it did. So, which was a very interesting point. If you have a way to externalize those problems, where somebody truly understands what it is that you're saying and what you meant, then all of a sudden the world turns around and you don't have all those chemical reactions that go on to cause you to be in problem, in pain, physically and emotionally and psychologically.
That's the same thing with being defended. When we can't express how we feel and we hold our emotions in, which was in my case, and a lot of people are in our listening audience haven't been able to express their emotions as a child. I mean, we oftentimes hear, "Don't cry, or I'll give you something to cry about." Or, you know, there's a lot of shared custody situations where children aren't allowed to cry when they're away from their mothers, and so they're holding in all these emotions. And when we hold emotions in, it causes us to be defended, and we can't express how we feel. We can't relax. It wears us out, and in that process, we don't even know who we are. We don't know ourselves. We don't trust ourselves, and this also creates a lack of trust in God and others. And so when we're defended, we also can't be spontaneous and open.
Now, by the way, how does hypnotherapy work with your clients?
Well, hypnotherapy is one of the things that I use, but I use a process that decreates the issue. So we inflate the issue and decreate it, and it's like a magic wand hits it and it disappears. So it's totally diffused. It gets into the unconscious mind.
Yeah. So in essence, you neutralize it.
Yes.
Okay, and if it's neutralized, there's no effect, so you can move through your life and get what you want out of your life. Where did you? I noticed you're certified. Where'd you get your training at?
In Atlanta, I'm with the National Guild of Hypnotists.
Oh, okay. I think it's a great place to be, because what I've seen with hypnotists on and off over the years, if they know what they're doing, it's phenomenal, because I really believe people walk around in a state of hypnosis, and it's the hypnotist's job not to hypnotize, but to dehypnotize. We walk around in a receptive state. And if a hypnotist knows what the hypnotist is doing, they bring down that level of sensitivity or receptiveness to the world around them, and people can deal from that point.
That's true. Oftentimes we see people driving down the road and they get to their place of work and sometimes wonder how they even got there. That is a state of hypnosis.
No, absolutely. You know, people have said, I've asked people over the years, I said, have you ever been hypnotized? Ah, no, of course not. And my contention has always been, go to a movie. Sit there and cry your eyes out. Why were you crying? You're sitting there looking at a movie, or you're angry, or you're frightened, and you got all these emotions going on. Something triggered. There was some kind of a suggestive idea that caused that emotion within you. So people walk around in that state. And people who say, I've never been hypnotized, you've never gone to a movie, or you've never watched somebody and got upset with their reactions. That really is what it's about.
Well, even shaving, you know, not that I stand in front of the mirror and shave, but for men, shaving or peeling vegetables in the kitchen, you get into that state of what I call being in neutral. It's the same thing as being hypnotized.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, and as you said, there's just one piece of it. And when people go through the coaching that you do, what did they come out like? What's the one thing, if there was an overarching theme, if there was a common denominator, what is it that they've dumped, and what did they do with their life from that point?
The pain and the suffering is over and done, and depression. Moving out of depression, when you think of how many millions of Americans are taking antidepressants, it's a huge number, and they're not even effective. So being able to sleep at night, the worry stops, and then they can have healthy relationships where they're able to communicate with one another without blaming. And that is key, is that we're not victims in our lives. We're actually co-creators with God. And when we're taking responsibility for our lives, we'll stop blaming others for everything that happens, because we actually create the situations for ourselves.
No question about it. Jennifer, we're just about out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. JenniferElizabethMasters.com. And you can order my book on that site. I also have a nonprofit organization called Victim to Victory Foundation. And anyone showing a proof of purchase for their book tonight will get a life-transforming session, a one-hour session from me.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so
much. My site.
Thank you so much for being on tonight.
Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark, and we're talking to Coyne Stephen Sanders. He's the co-author of Desilu, the story of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. He's the author of the critically acclaimed Rainbow's End, The Judy Garland Show, and The Dick Van Dyke Show, Anatomy of a Classic. And in addition to writing for Variety, he's covered television for The Hollywood Reporter and Emmy magazines. And let us say, Stephen, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to see you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I still find myself walking down the hallway, and this is 2011, saying nerds to merts. do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, nerds to merts. Why is it that they endured? It was such a classic that it stayed with us today. And that's, I think, what was she going to be, what, 100 years old this week?
Exactly, yeah. Lucy will be 60 years old next month.
Wow.
So I think it's several reasons. I think it's because of the great writing that the show had. I think it's because of the wonderful supporting cast and Lucy and Desi themselves. But I think primarily it was because the love that Lucy and Desi had for each other. I think that was genuine. I think that absolutely transcends an old black and white television show. And I think it's so real. I think that the viewers today can pick up on that. I think that's what makes the show so special.
No, no question about it. And I think what they did, obviously, I'm sure they had scripts, but there was no way that you could follow a script with what they did. Well, most of that had to be impromptu.
It had to be what?
Oh, it had to be impromptu. It had to be just off the top of their head.
Well, actually not. Lucy called it the black stuff on the page, that the stuff is all written down to the nth degree by the writers, and it was Lucy's job to kind of make it come to life. So in that respect, it was improvised, because she would take it, the words in the page, and turn it into something that was absolutely special. But Lucy was absolutely fearless. When they said to her, Lucy, want you to learn how to go make a pizza, she'd go to a pizza place in Hollywood Boulevard in California and learn how to make a pizza, or we want you to play the violin or the trombone, or learn how to do something or other, and she would actually nail it and have it done by the time of the show would be in rehearsal.
You know, when we really come down to it, you know, you go back to the 50s, and I remember that she would, it was almost like you grew up with them. It was part of the family. And I remember her before she met Desi Arnaz, you know, in some of the movies that she was in. I mean, she was absolutely gorgeous. But the but comedy, where was it that she entered the world of comedy? Because there were movies she was in that were not funny early on, and she was wonderful, but then we remember her as a comedian.
Well, that's right. I mean, it seems like Isle of Lucy captures only a certain moment in time, and I don't even know if Lucy was aware at the time of how brilliant she was and where that came from. I think it's still a mystery about where there were flashes of that early on in some of the other movies that she did, but never to that extent, where she was absolutely brilliant. And I think that not only was she a beautiful woman, she could deliver lines wonderfully, and also she had this great being adept at physical comedy, that there was no other woman like her.
Yeah, you know, Desi Arnaz was good. There's no question about that. But the show was Lucille Ball. I mean, any way you look at it, that entire thing was her, and there was something that was so charismatic about her and so funny, and at the same time, she wasn't above the audience. The people could relate to her. It was like someone in the family.
No, very much, very much. I think that the characters were all grounded in reality. And, you know, the supporting players of Vivian and William Frawley, as far as the landlady and her husband. I think that it was all – that's what Lucy's gift, too, that she made – absolutely outrageous situations believable. She, you know, like the bread that came out of the oven, or a putty in William Holden's nose on her nose that it was melted by William Holden's match. I mean, whatever it might be, that you were so invested in the characters, you went along for the ride and you believe them because Lucy made it believable.
Yeah, and I remember what scene was that when they were barefoot and they were squashing grapes? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what was not what was, you know, talking about improvised? What was not expected was the woman in the wine vat who actually took a slug at Lucy and pulled her down, and that wasn't in the script. And that was an absolutely spontaneous reaction. Lucy went along with it, and that became one of the greatest bits in the show.
Now, Desi Arnaz himself, you know, he wasn't really much of, he wasn't a comedian. I mean, he was a great entertainer, but off the set, it wasn't quite as loving as it was on the set, was it?
Well, he was actually a wonderful businessman, and that's, I think, one of the unfun things that we talk about in the book, that he was not trained, yet he not only did the on-camera performing part of Lucy, he also ran an empire of Desilu Studios, and it became huge. And it you know, became the home of Mission Impossible and Mannix and Star Trek, and this is all based on Desi's business genius. So he really was a genius.
Yeah, and you know, and you really go back and you think about the way it was and the entertainment that we had on television. I really miss that. There was an innocence about it. There wasn't the you know, there was some drama in it occasionally, but for the most part, it just allowed you to step out of reality for a while and just get in there and have absolute fun. And she wasn't enamored with herself. I think that's what it was.
No.
She wasn't about herself. She was about the audience.
No, she never thought of herself as a big star, and she was very much, you know, a girl from Jamestown, New York, and never kind of lost that common touch about her, that she was just folks.
When you were in the process of this with the research and putting it together, what did you learn? And when I say what did you learn, what things came up that you weren't aware of that made you sit back and really take a look?
Well, a few things. One thing is, I said before, that what a brilliant businessman that Desi was. I had no idea to the extent that he was. In fact, that it was Desi who kind of created the rerun marks, because it was him who did refine the three-camera technique of putting a live audience and three cameras to film Isla Lucy and use 35-millimeter film, which then became the rerun because they had all these wonderful films of film quality, and they could use them again and again and again. So he kind of semi-accidentally but created the rerun market. And another thing that I learned writing the book was that Lucy Ricardo was nothing like Lucille Ball, that they were very, very different people, that people tended, especially back in the day, people thought, oh, well, Lucy Ricardo was Lucille Ball, and that really wasn't true. They were two very, very different people, the lines tend to get blurred by the public, but Lucille was a not very funny woman. She always said, I'm not funny, my writers think funny. She's a no-nonsense, all-business, sort of brusque, controlling woman, and she was not childlike and sweet and endearing the way that Lucy Ricardo was. That she was, that she was a very, very different person than that.
Was she tough?
She was tough.
Yeah, you would think so. If you really look,
success came late in life to her, as we say in the book. That she was 40 when Isla Lucy started. And she'd been kicking around Hollywood for about 15, 20 years. And, Columbia doing getting pies in the face and seltzer with the Three Stooges and the Marx Brothers and things like that. So she'd been around for quite a while, knocking around, and nothing really had quite happened. And she went to RKO, and nothing really happened there. And then she went to MGM, and they were going to make her a glamour girl. Nothing really quite worked with that. And then she wanted freelancing. So by the time Isla Lucy came around, her career was sort of on the downslide. She was known as Queen of the Bees. She'd done about 85 B pictures. And Desi was a band leader who had started the conga craze in New York and Cafe Society, but that was sort of winding down. So really, if Isla Lucy hadn't happened at that time, who knows what would have happened to them. So that was a surprise, too, that we discovered in writing the book.
What was in the very beginning, what was it that caused you to sit down and actually put this to pen? What was it about, what started the, I'm going to call it the Lucy book. What was it about her that caused you to sit down and put all this to pen?
It caused me to write the book. I think that there hadn't been a book about their lives that really told the truth, and also counter to that there wasn't really a look at the studio and a look at Desi running the studio. So I thought it was interesting to show the juxtaposition of the personal life and the professional life under one cover, and I think that we try to do that in the book, that we, we show the nuts and bolts of the golden age of television, which I think is a fascinating time for me because that's what I write about, but also about these two wonderful people, that the thing that they designed to bring them together, I Love Lucy, did for a long period of time, and then it pulled them apart. So the thing that brought them together is ultimately what caused their divorce.
Yeah, now that's very interesting because when she got divorced, the man she married, it was a completely different world for her, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
Oh, the man she married after Desi.
Oh, Gary Morton, yes.
Yeah, there was a different world for her, wasn't it? It wasn't
it wasn't the love of her life. It wasn't a passionate love, but it makes sense because she'd come off the bad years of Desi and of him drinking steadily, and he was arrested at Bordello, and Lucy could not take public humiliation. And Desi offered, and so Gary offered calm. He made her laugh. He was a stand-up comic, and he was there when she wanted him to be there. So it was a very different kind of marriage. But she actually wanted being married to Gary longer than she was actually married to Desi.
Huh. It's interesting when you really think about it.
I mean, Desi was in love with his life, and they were in love with each other to the day they died, and they spoke to each other every day of their life. And we end the book by telling a wonderful story that Lucy Arnaz tells us, that Lucy was the last person to talk to Desi on his deathbed.
Do you think that if he hadn't played the way he did, they would have probably stayed together?
I'm sorry?
If he hadn't of done what he did, it was with other women, etc., do you think if that hadn't been part of his life, you think they would have stayed together?
I think it was that and the drinking got worse. Somebody said to us that when you ordered tomato soup for breakfast, that means you're in trouble because that meant vodka and tomato soup. That is, the pressure is built. And he kind of felt overlooked by the industry, that he wasn't getting the acclaim that Lucy was. And just the pressure of running a multi-million-dollar television studio, an empire, it was enormous pressures. he was self-taught, and I think that the womanizing, which was his Cuban heritage, he didn't understand. He was saying, "I'm not dating hookers. I'm not dating women. I'm just going out with hookers." He couldn't understand why she couldn't accept that. But of course, Lucy was a very different kind of moralistic person,
sure,
who could not deal with that kind of public humiliation. So I think it was the womanizing, the drinking, I think together, plus they had different personalities, that she was very controlling too, that she wanted things to be a certain way, and he wouldn't conform to that. So, but I think it was sort of doomed. I mean, the things that brought them together, the differences, kind of fueled their great passion. But ultimately, and as he said later on, maybe the problem is that we were together too much, that they're working together, they're married together, they're trying to raise their kids together. And I think that it just became too much.
Now, by the way, Vivian Vance, were they friends off the set?
Yes, they were. They had kind of a sisterly rivalry. I mean, but Lucy and Vivian were very, very close. And Vivian was one of the few people who could tell Lucy what to do, give her suggestions, and Lucy would believe it. She'd back down and say, "Yeah, you're right." So she respected Vivian. And we have a wonderful story in the book that when Vivian was dying of cancer, that Lucy and Mary Wicks, who were another close friend of Vivian, went to go see Vivian and spent hours with her and just reminiscing about old times. And it was a very emotional, loving, sort of tear-filled goodbye that they spent. So they loved each other until the end.
Wow. You know, if you really go back and you take a look at it, it was a story. It was not only a love story between the two of them. It was a love story between Lucille Ball and the rest of the country. She was part of the family. I can't imagine anybody who didn't love Lucy. And when they created the name for it, the I Love Lucy really captured not only the generations, but it captured a world that, look at us, here it is, 2011. We're talking about them.
That's right. 6 years later.
Yeah, and I'm starting the show with Nerds to Merts. All the good stuff. Let me ask you this. Is there a website that we can find you at?
We have, I think it's DesiLu.tv, but if people want the book, it's out now. That they can order the book on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. And last we heard it was in the top 100 of biographies out, which is wonderful for us because it's just been out for less than a week. So, so if people want to get the book, I would say probably Amazon is probably the best place to get it.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Great, great book, and thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Off comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise, the curtains fall, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
We're parting out as friends, your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. if I had this to do again. And the evening were new again. I would spend it with you.